Welcome to Got Invention Radio. I'm your host, Brian Fried, and tonight we have a special guest from All Star Products Group. His name is John Hurley, and he is part of the company that actually came up with several marketing initiatives. Have you ever heard of the Snuggie? How about Perfect Pancake or Perfect Tortilla? And I know that there's other products that All Star Products Groups are currently involved with, and we have John on our show to tell us about it. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in tonight.
So, John, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and All Star Products Group?
Sure. Again, thank you, everyone, for tuning in. My name is John Hurley, and I work in the merchandising team at All Star Products Group. All Star is an as seen on TV, or in a more technical term, direct response television company. So our main job is to find a product that we can market on TV with the eventual goal of getting to retail and selling on the as seen on TV sets. A little background on myself. My road to merchandising at All Star was kind of a little bit of a windy one. I started in the creative side of the business. So on the creative team, working through commercials, working on web comps, getting assets, images, making sure we're getting the right message across to the consumer. So I started there. Then made my way over to the DR team, who is a little more analytic, you know, more analyzing results, a little more math, I guess. Looking at results as far as TV, web, who's clicking through, who's ordering, what's the order size, stuff like that. And eventually had an opening merchandising. I come from a sales background, and really was kind of drawn to the idea of looking for products. It seemed like a really fun, different way of doing things. Jumped into that about 2 years, a little over 2 years ago now, and have been doing that ever since. Main job function as a merchandiser is to find the next big hit. I reference Snuggie a lot because, well, everyone knows Snuggie. I think everyone probably either listening in either has one or probably knows someone that owns one themselves. Big hit. So my job is to find the next one.
All right. Sounds great. Sounds like a plan. And
yeah.
Now there's inventors that are listening that have products, inventions that they've been working on, and they're at all different stages of the invention process. And some of them may have a product that is a DRTV, as it's known as, which is Direct Response TV product. And we hope that during the show you'll share some of the insight with us to make a decision if it's something that we should present to you or any DRTV company. Is our product a DRTV product? And it would be great for you to help us out with that for sure.
Of course, of course. I guess we could start by just kind of going over what DRTV is in general, just a really brief definition, just to kind of get a base here. Basically, DRTV it includes any television advertising that asks a consumer to respond directly to the company by either the 800 number you see go across the screen or a website. That's real traditional DR, direct response. Over the years, it's changed. You're still using that same formula, but now the commercials, the websites are all used as a way of building awareness so that when the consumers get to Walmart, your Walgreens, the major retailers, they see it on the shelf and they already know what it does, the price it was on TV, and they already know they want it. So it's really now a way of building building awareness and motivating people to buy at retail. So most sales now in DRTV are retail sales. You're still having a lot of sales done on both TV and the web, but now more retail than ever. There's also two different forms of direct response television as well, short and long. Short form, that's what All Star is involved in, 2 minutes and below. At 2 minutes and below, we're selling something that's $19.95 and below. A long-form infomercial, perfect example, would be your Bowflex gym or any, let's see, HSN QVC item, something that needs a full half an hour to get across to the consumer. So DRTV, you're marketing through TV to retail. There's two different forms, short and long. As far as knowing if your product's right for DRTV, as far as industry is concerned, there's certain criteria that we all look for. I can only speak on All Star's behalf, but these criteria I'll give you guys now are actually something that will kind of fit across all companies within the industry. Number one, I have to say, main product criteria. So if you're asking yourself, what is my product right for TV? It has to have a problem solution. Has to have a problem solution. You all probably watch, you've seen infomercials, you've been up Saturday early morning, Sunday early morning, and TV comes on, and someone's having this problem. The screen's black and white. And then suddenly the DRTV, the product that we're selling to you or trying to pitch to you, solves that problem. Everything turns to color and everything is great. It's that problem solution that gets people to order on TV. It's what motivates people. Without that, it's just anything else. You need to be able to get people off the couch to order. So a problem solution is huge. It gets the orders to the TV, people ordering, pulling out their credit card, and the theory really being, if you get someone to order on TV with that problem solution, you'll definitely have an opportunity for them to sell that item to them in retail when they're actually going to be able to touch it, see it, and feel it. Another major criteria for DRTV would be the uniqueness. We're pitching on TV. Everyone is very familiar with major retailers. Everyone walks the aisles. They've seen probably almost everything that's out there. They go to their Amazons, they go to their Googles, and they see everything. So the key for us, if they see everything, they also know they can buy it in retail. So we need to make sure we offer them something that they don't think they can get anywhere else. Which a lot of times why you see on the end, order now for the special TV offer, you won't find it in stores. Another motivating factor for people to buy, it's unique. They don't think they can get it anywhere else. And it solves a problem I mentioned before in a unique way.
Okay. So it's really about, I guess when we're saying DRTV, it's really that it starts off on TV and then gets distributed out to the different retailers. Is that why it's called DRTV, or is there actually a DR, direct response?
Yeah, so direct response comes from really that when you're marketing on TV, you're looking for people to respond directly to your marketing, to your TV commercial. They're asking you to go straight to the website to order. It's direct. And as I mentioned earlier, it's changed. Maybe 10, 15 years ago, most of your sales, people were picking up that phone and could dial that number and ordering that product off that phone number. The website probably, I don't know, about 15, 20 years ago, obviously, but the phone numbers were huge. But now really what it's used as a inexpensive way of marketing the item, building awareness, so that when they get to retail, that's where you move all your major units.
Okay.
So the model has changed. We're still going about it and pitching it the same way, but the way we sell to the consumers has changed over the years. Now it's really a big retail strategy.
Okay.
More so than ever, which is why when you go to, Walmart at the end, checking out, just recently I was there 2 weeks ago, all the products from DRTV companies are all there, and they're stacked up pretty deep on those retail shelves. That's where you're moving the most of quantity.
Sure. John, yeah. here's the thing that I'm wondering, though, because I hear people in the DRTV, direct response TV world, that says the product has to be for mass retail. But then you go to the stores and you see a little needle, you see something for automotive, you see something really specific for travel. So is it really that it needs to be mass, or is it something that can be specific for a specific industry that, from a this side perspective, to see it almost in a catalog, a specialty catalog, but there's different DRTV companies that are putting it to the masses?
Yeah, and that you actually nailed exactly what my next point was as far as, the criteria. We really do look for things that hit mass market, that have mass market appeal. You'll see your products out there that seem to be focused towards a certain group of people. But depending on the company, we really are trying to find something that appeals to everyone. Really the reason behind it being, if there's a certain percentage, I don't know that percentage, but there is one, of how many people order off of TV. We're trying to, and it's a small segment of the market, you're trying to appeal to as many of those people as you can so that you have enough people ordering on TV to lower the cost of your TV campaign so you could build the campaign and run more of it to build awareness for retail.
Right.
So the key is to really... you know, you're really trying to appeal to the masses to get as many people to order and to really have a large campaign. Because remember, a successful DRTV campaign, you know, it's not a very long, unless it's a Snuggie or a perfect meatloaf pan, you're not in the market for long. So you have to sell as many of those products as quickly as possible, but over a short amount of time. And by in order to do that, you need to have a mass market appeal. So we do look for that.
Okay. So give us some examples, John, of some products that your company and you have taken and basically brought to a level of success.
One in particular, which I'm very close to, is the Grifco Carmel, which is currently running on TV now, and you might find it at some of the retailers. That was a perfect example of it's a product that's unique, never been out there before. Solve the problem. I think everyone here could probably relate to the fact that when you're driving in your car, where do you put your cell phone? You put in your cup holder, but you're taking up a cup space. You probably put it in a little handle there to open your doors, but it falls out. So this is presented to me, and he really kind of got, you know, the product source put it out on the line and said, it meets all your criteria, solves that problem. And it was mass appeal, you know. Yes, granted, not everyone drives, but the majority of people, you could probably make an argument, have a vehicle of some sort or have and understand the problem. Just really an all-around, and it's getting a great response now. It was demonstrable. I mean, the demos were great on TV. You could, because, you know, the big thing, too, you need to make sure it's credible. People need to believe that it's going to do what it's supposed to do. So when you can demo it, you can show it on TV. I mean, so far it's been a home run. Got another example, I'd say. Perfect Tortilla was interesting. You mentioned that at the start of the show.
Yep.
You know, that was something that if it came across our desk early on, maybe we wouldn't have tackled it. But, you know, what that allowed us to do is take a product that, you know, some people couldn't make a tortilla shell at home. We then provided them with a way of doing that. And I think if you look in the market, if you go to your, we're on the East Coast here, so if you go to your Desert Moon cafes or you go to your Chipotle's, you're going to see those tortilla shells. So they started catching on, a little bit of a trend. Now we're able to provide the masses with a solution to that problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we pitched it. You could do it dinner, snacks, even desserts in it. So the commercial really sold that item as well. And it does what it's supposed to. It really performs the way we pitch it.
Okay.
Which goes back to the credibility part. So, yeah, those are a couple examples of products that we took to market that were that mass appeal, that have been doing very, very well for us so far.
That sounds good. There's a listener that sent in an email. By the way, for those listeners who don't have my email address, you can email me brian@gotinvention.com. You can email me your questions, and I'll ask John live. Jennifer from Texas is asking, how do you come up with all these names?
How do you come up with the names? that's a good question. So we have creative meetings. You know, different members of the company sit in, and really, honestly, it's a brainstorming session. You know, there is a science to these names. You know, these silly names or these names that people think are silly, they work. So we kind of, not that we go out looking for a silly name, but we just stick to, you know, everything's kind of an alliteration. They kind of rhyme, and we stick to that. So it's just it's a collaborative effort to come up with a name, and we always try to make sure that the name has something to do with the product and what the problem it's solving. A perfect tortilla and our perfect line, you know, we really believe that these products create the perfect meatloaf, brownie, tortilla. So it only makes sense. It's part of the brand.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a group effort.
So, John, I'm an inventor, and I have products that I would present, and I'm talking for the other inventors listening out there, where I'd come to you and say, I have a product. What sort of test should I do? Because I believe that my product, everybody in the world and other world should have it. So what do I need to do first to kind of sift through and give myself kind of my own screening before I present to somebody like you? What do I need to do, John?
Okay. So in other words, what should an inventor do sitting home to say, okay, is this the right product for DRTV?
Yes.
Make sure it's unique. do your research on Google search. Sounds pretty simple and, you know, kind of elementary, but it's true. Do a Google search. See if there's anything else in the market that solves the same problem. See if your product, how it matches up to it. Think to yourself, how many, you know, going back to mass market, how many people does this reach? Does it solve a real problem? A lot of times when we evaluate, we're looking at, is this solving an annoyance? Is it something that just happens and it'd be nice to have? Or is it solving a problem that, I mean, really annoys you and gets to you on a fairly frequent basis? And honestly, another thing, Brian, too, very, very important, is it priced right? And that goes back to the company that you're pitching it to. All-Star, I can only speak for All-Star, but we're a short-form DRTV company, so we only market 1995 and below. So the product that you bring it to All-Star, if that's the case, has to cost of goods has to be in line. So you're talking a pretty low cost of goods.
Okay. I always give this type of scenario, John. I mean, I'm going to keep it really to a minimum here, but I mean, let's say I come up with a woman's heel, some kind of unique functionality to a woman's heel.
Okay.
So, you know, you think about it right away, you're limiting your window of opportunity. It's not all men and it's pretty much all women and it's really no men, right? Because you're talking about a woman's heel. Then, you know, there's the functionality of it. Is it something that's going to attach? That makes it more marketable for the women. But if it's specifically for a unique design that's connected to it, then it's also another factor where you have to consider, look, there's millions of shoes out there. Is that design really going to be appealing to somebody else, even though it has that function? So it seems like whatever it is always something that could be used with something else and not exactly by itself. Right?
We tackle that a lot. You know, there's certain products that, like you said, the heel's a good example, or even a shoe, for example. You know, there's slippers, things like that. You need to make sure it has that mass appeal if you're bringing fashion to the mix. You know, it's another barrier to entry. You know, it's another thing that someone has to consider. And you could bring a product that, like the heel idea, that fits every shoe. They don't have to think twice about it, and it solves a problem for them. Mm-hmm. It doesn't alter the way their foot or their shoe looks. You're going to have a much easier time of marketing that product if, let's say, it only works on kiddie heels. I learned that term recently at All-Star. I didn't know that before, but a kiddie heel, for example.
Okay.
You know, you could really, having it more universal, less sizes, definitely makes it a lot easier.
Speaking of kiddie, tell me why, like, tell me some of the products that All-Star Products Group has been involved with in the kids arena. And I know that some of them have been pretty successful. And why have they been successful? Since we're talking about mass appeal, but you're focused just on kids. Now, not everybody has kids.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes the kids category is a tough one to pin down. You know, it doesn't really follow your traditional DR, you know, all those metrics I gave you before, all the criteria, because, you know, the challenge is, you know, kids can't order off the TV. So you have to market to a kid through a kid network and then have them then tell their parents they want it and have their parents order it. So you're having a lot more barriers to entry for that product. A couple of good examples, though, of some success stories that we've had. Bendaroos was big for us. It's the bendable kids toy, almost like a building block in a way, like building sticks. Great product, inexpensive to manufacture. Small retail box. You could put a ton of them on the retail shelves. And it was appealing to kids. It really was. Another one for us years ago was Touch and Brush. The touch-free toothpaste dispenser that sticks to your wall. We co-branded that with some Nickelodeon, I believe SpongeBob, or maybe Dora was on there. So we don't do a lot of kids. We are looking for the next kid hit. It's just a tough way to evaluate, you know. But we've done it, and we are looking for the next one. So everyone keep that in mind.
So, I mean, when you're thinking about mass appeal, you're talking about tortillas. And not everybody in the country eats tortillas. You're talking about kids' products. Not everybody has kids. Mm-hmm. So when you're saying mass appeal, I mean, it seems like certain categories have enough mass appeal to really just consider them mass appeal.
Yeah, you know, when I say mass, I mean, we're never going to, you know, sell a product that fits everybody's needs, thinking that would just be unrealistic. But we can do our best to serve as many people as we can, and through the marketing behind it, maybe some people don't think they have that problem, and maybe some people don't really necessarily think that they want to make a tortilla basket, but through our marketing, we will, I guess, in a way, create that sense of urgency.
Okay.
But yeah, you know, we can't appeal to everybody. It's a matter of really appealing to as many as you can. And maybe, honestly, more than anything, it's having that mindset of mass appeal. You really got to pitch to as many as you can.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. I mean, it's also trial and error. It sounds to me from speaking to you prior to the show that there's different ways for you to really test when you're saying that you're doing marketing research. There also may be different commercials that you put on in certain areas, like you'll put a little bit of investment into a commercial and test it in certain areas and see what kind of response you get to see if you're going to pursue it even further. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. You know, so as far as testing, and this is pretty standard throughout the industry, I'm not specific to Allstar, but when you build a commercial and you market it on TV, you're not just throwing it on any random channel to get to whoever. You're also targeting the consumers you're going after. So many times, you know, so if it's a kid's item, like I mentioned before, you probably wouldn't be pitching that on a military channel or something that does kids related. You're going to be your Nickelodeon, your Cartoon Networks. If it's a cooking item, or maybe that's better yet, mail item, mail-oriented item, you're going to put it on some ESPN, ESPN2, Fox News Channel maybe. So you're tailoring the commercial where you're pitching it to the consumer that you're going after.
Okay.
And as far as testing, you know, there's multiple ways of doing that. There's, you know, this is pretty standard throughout the industry too. You know, there's surveys you can do and to gauge interest and eventually gets to TV and it's tested. We tell it to the consumer that we're going after.
Okay. We started a little earlier in the show to talk about when I have an idea and I present it to you, what happens. And you started off by saying to Google it. That sounds to me like an inventor can just have an idea in their head, Google it, and then send it over to you. Is that sufficient enough to present an idea to you?
You know, I meant as far as Googling, what I mentioned Google before is doing your research to make sure that, I mean, I can't even count how many times it's happened where people bring to me their idea. And I've seen, not maybe the same exact thing, but I've seen, you know, pretty products that solve the same problem this pretty similar way. And it just shows me that the research wasn't done before it. So as far as Googling, just make sure you do the research before to make sure that it doesn't already exist in Walmart. It's not already been selling for the last 20 years on Amazon or whatever it may be in retail. It's about doing the research to make sure that it's unique.
Absolutely. So once they end up finding out that it's unique, what happens next? You know, typically from an inventor's perspective, they like to get some sort of intellectual property possibly before they present to you, maybe having what you said before, having a prototype. You know, if they're on the other side of the country and not able to pitch to you in person, maybe there's other ways to present to you. What's your take on that, John?
Of course, yeah. So, you know, one of the major things I get is, do I need a patent? The answer to that is no. I mean, and that's for all, and again, I can only speak on Allstar's behalf, but from what I know and I understand it, everyone else in the industry along with ourselves, you don't require a patent. What we do, though, provide to you as far as safety, because obviously if you don't have a patent, you're going to be worried about that product going elsewhere. We will sign a non-disclosure agreement, send that over to you, could review it, so we can protect you that way and make you feel a little more comfortable. As far as the prototype is concerned, again, only specific to Allstar, we would like to see things in a more of a finished state. So things have come across to me on graph paper and napkins and all that good stuff, but we would like to see something maybe in the prototyping stage. Not to say that you have to go out and get it manufactured overseas. I've had people build things in a garage for me. Basically, a proof of concept. Proof of concept to make sure that the idea that you're pitching me will do and say what it's supposed to.
Okay, so it doesn't need to be a finished product. It could be a prototype, and it could be a respectable prototype. It doesn't have to be a perfected prototype. It has to just function and do what you expect it to do, and just so you can visualize it and get the idea. These days, a lot of people have these 3D drawings where, you know, things can flip upside down, left, right, you know, hang from the ceiling. You know, they do all these different things from the 3D drawings. Is that acceptable to you, John?
What happens a lot with those is that people will bring them to me and say, John, what's your initial interest? If you have some initial interest there, I'll explore making a prototype. And that's usually the route I like to take. I could put it in front of the team and, again, evaluate based on what I have in front of me. But until I have something physical that works and or works close to what it's supposed to, we can't make a true decision on the product until then. So I'll review it internally. I'll put it in front of the right people. But we're going to have to see something a little more finished. And I can tell you if it's something that interests us or not. You know, we're not going to... We're not there to waste anyone's time.
No, of course. And it sounds to me like you'd like to have some sort of proof of concept there. I mean, I'm sure that you get calls with people that are saying, you know, I have an idea. Can you help me with it, my idea? And, you know, like you said, you do a quick Google search and you find it online. You just help them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the challenge too, Brian, is that, you know, it's I would love to take an idea that's just kind of, I mean, everything sounds great, right, when you say, hey, John, I got this idea about this product that's going to solve this and that. Well, that's great, and I would love to see it, but I need to I'd like to see it happen, but I need to see some proof of concept.
Right. You need the inventor to do their due diligence, and we speak about this on the show quite a bit, John, where you got to do your search. You said it before. Just do a simple Google search to start with, and then go to the next search engine and put in different variations of the concept that you have. Descriptive ways to see if they come up, and don't be afraid. If it comes up, move on to the next idea. If it's something that you have potential with, then you may want to gather that information, bring it to an intellectual property patent or agent, let them take a look at it and compare it to what you have and see if it's enough of a difference that you're not going to infringe on somebody's intellectual property. And if it's something that already exists for a certain amount of time, then it's public domain. And it can't get any kind of protection. So really, it starts to get a little tight with you then, John, because what do you really need the inventor for if they don't have any intellectual property?
Well, you know, I think I always tell everyone that gives I speak with, you know, a lot of the products that come through the doors are from vendors and product sources. The value that every people like I'm speaking to now, they hold is their product. We could do all the Google searches and all everything that we want. Bottom line is, though, when we do those searches, those are already out there. People already know them. It's the unique, different, new stuff that comes to us that really becomes the winners, that really stands out in the market. We do our own research. We try to find things in the little odds, you know, the dark places of the Internet. But those are few and far between. It's stuff that comes from people like yourself. That's a lot of the products that we have.
Okay. So You're okay with bringing it up to the prototype stage. What about the intellectual property? How serious is that to you when we're presenting a product to you?
Quite honestly, we don't require it. You could have no patents whatsoever. Most come to us no patent pending. You could have neither. Because we're going to do our due diligence. If we decide to work with it, we're going to do our due diligence on our end to make sure that we're not infringing or anything along those lines. So we don't require it. I know that makes people worry about, you know, All-Star or another company taking off with their product. And I'm speaking on All-Star's behalf. You know, the product is safe. Once it comes to All-Star, it doesn't go anywhere else.
Okay.
I can assure you that. But that's why we sign the NDAs and make you feel a little more comfortable.
Okay. I have a question from a listener. It's Mason from Georgia, and they're asking about non-disclosure agreements. So I think this is a perfect segue into that question. So if I have a product and I'm presenting it to All-Star, do they sign a non-disclosure agreement?
Yes, and what we do, we have a standard non-disclosure, no surprises. We send that out and require that the product store sign our non-disclosure. We don't do that to kind of get around anything there or to kind of be shady about anything. Really why we do that, as you can imagine, we see multiple, tons of product on a daily basis. If we had to review every NDA that came through the door, we might have to build another building just for a legal department.
Okay, but your NDA, I mean, realistically, you see many products. So what if an inventor signed one with you and then you basically said, I just saw that umbrella variation just yesterday. What do you do at that point?
At that point, I mean, that's a good question. So once a product is shown to us and non-disclosure is signed, I mean, we don't talk about it beyond the one-on-one conversation that I have with the inventor. If someone brings me something that's similar, it's honest, we just tell them no thank you. It's something that we've, through the years seen before and don't think it's a big enough problem. But as far as getting the information out, the valuable information, that does not leave the conversation between the both of us.
Okay.
Or the department, for that matter.
Okay, that's respectable. So
yeah.
On the other side, you see a product, you like it, then what happens next, John? I think you mentioned it goes to your internal team. Everybody has a meeting, takes a look at the product, and they love it, they like it, they don't like it. I'm sure there's some kind of proxy vote there.
Oh, yes. we have a whole internal review process. Not giving out too many of our secrets. It's all committee-based. We have people from all walks of life, so you're different ages, from the age of, fresh out of college, middle, upper aged, male, female, reviewing the products. For the main reason that we don't want to miss anything. Everyone comes from different backgrounds. We learn a lot from each person in that meeting. Maybe, for example, Hot Buns, I could have told you, was a great, unique item. It's the create the sock bun for the women. It's out on the market now. I could have told you it was unique. I could have told you it had magic. But I could have never told you if it was a problem or not. And that's why we do it at committee, because women said, this is a problem. This is something that's going to solve this problem. So everything's committee-based. So it goes through that. We vote. And then if it's something we want to work with, we come back and we start working out the terms.
Okay.
Term sheet is kind of a gentleman's agreement until the contract is signed. If it's not, we come back and say, hey, listen, thank you so much. We'd love to see more of your items. And we hope to work with you one day down the road, because it is a numbers game.
Okay. And
the more products in, the better.
It's fine. And speaking of numbers, so what can an inventor expect to make, really, when you say, let's go for it? But before we talk about the cash that they make, what does it take for a product? I mean, you mentioned a little bit of the way that it's marketed once you have a commercial and it goes to retail. But once you say yes, next week, is the product out on the shelf and a commercial up on TV?
No. So let's say, I'm not going to say it's a long process, but it's... We try to beat the market, or at least be up on TV testing. We require 210 to 70 day testing period for a product. And it seems like it's a lot, but it's a very, in order to do our background work on a product, so you're doing legal patent research, you're trademarking a name, you're doing the creative behind it, and then you're testing it by media, you're talking about a pretty extended time, pretty long time to make sure we're doing it the right way. So you're talking almost, before you see it in retail, if everything were to work, easily a year and a half, depending on the season, depending on when we're going to roll it out.
Wow.
But it's not you can't expect to sign something with us and see a commercial the next week. If we did that, we'd honestly probably be irresponsible on our part.
Okay. Well, that's good to know, because, it's very important people's expectations are met. And as long as that's disclosed to us, especially telling us this kind of information on the show, obviously it helps everybody, because I think that, you know, people expect things a lot quicker. And it sounds to me like between the production, first it's the development of the way the product is going to be designed and function. And it might be a little different than what the inventor presents. And then I'm sure you have the naming judging. And then there's all the setup of what the commercial is going to be like. Probably before that, when is it that you start to approach the retailers, or do you get them involved in your decisions on what goes on TV?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Everything is internal. No one knows of any of our projects until we know that they're rollout, until we know that they're successful. To kind of piggyback off of what you were saying before,
sure.
It's not that we're not. That's a pretty quick turnaround time. It's a matter of finding a fine line between you want to get to market first, but at the same time, you don't want to rush there. Just for the main fact, you want to give it every chance to succeed. So we rush the name, we rush the creative, we rush the sourcing and don't get the price we need to be. These are all potential roadblocks for down the road and also reasons why maybe it wouldn't work. So it's a matter of finding that balance between, we need to get there fast. At the same time, though, we need to do a quality job.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. So now the time goes by. Is the inventor or whoever's product that is moving along your process, are they actively involved, or do you plan on speaking to them in a year and a half?
For All-Star, that's one of the great advantages of working with All-Star. You have a personal touch. You have a contact in creative. You have a contact myself that you could reach out to, ask questions. When it gets to the creative point, we're not afraid to ask you, why'd you create it? Hey, are we missing something on the web composition? Hey, are we missing something on the commercial? What do you guys think about this line? Should we add something? You're not forgotten. We don't disappear on you for 6 months and then come back and tell you no or yes on anything. We're very transparent. Very transparent, very open, and that's just something that you learn working with us. It's a fun group of people to work with.
Okay. So now getting down to one of the main questions, a couple of listeners sent in the question of what can an inventor expect to make in many different words. But what does it really come down to, John? How does the formula work out for them?
So, without getting too much into it, because every product is different, every deal is different, I'll give you some ranges of, so everything is a royalty-based system. So you're compensated on sales, whether we break it down into, there's different types of sales, but you have a different percentage from wherever that product is sold, from what channel. So if it's a retail sale, you're going to have a royalty for the retail. If it's sold somewhere else, you're going to have a royalty for that. In a range, your retail royalty, you're looking anywhere from 2 to 4, 2 to 5%, depending, and that's on the wholesale retail price.
Okay.
And then, if it's sold, let's say through a website or anything along those lines, it's going to be, let's say, 1 to 3, 1 to 4%.
Okay. And the reason is because when you're selling it on the website or TV, it's direct to consumer, so the margin is there. So it's a higher price, so you're getting a little less on the royalty. And when it's wholesale to the retailers, it's obviously there's another layer that's there.
Well, the main reason behind it, and kind of going back to how it started off the show, was that most of the sales now, and it's changed, let's say, from 10 years ago, are done in retail. So you're getting a higher royalty at retail because, well, that's where the majority of the sales are. So we believe strongly that you should have a bigger cut of the pie, so to speak, at that point. Most of them are sold at retail. So you get the higher retail royalty there.
Okay. Yep. A lot of inventors might be listening and saying, wow, 1 to 4% here, it doesn't really sound like much. Is it over 1,000 units, 10,000 units, 100,000, maybe you can put that number into perspective for a successful product?
I could tell you, as far as campaigns concerned, the units, there's different size DRTV companies, All-Star being one of the larger, if not the largest, up in the top bracket there. you know, one of our campaigns, you know, we're, like I said, disappointed, but we're looking for, we're looking to sell millions of units, not 50,000, not 10,000, millions of them. So you can imagine on those, without getting into too many, you know, details as far as numbers, those percentages become a very large amount. And also the other reason, basically, kind of remember, working with a company like Allstar, you are not paying a dime. We never ask you for a cent on the value that you hold to us as your product. And all the financial risk and is taken on by Allstar. The time that you sign that over, you know, the product over to us and we reach that agreement, responsibility is ours. The manufacturing is our, you know, responsibility is ours. And a lot of people don't understand is that when you work with a big retailer like your Walmarts and, you know, I'm not sure about Walgreens, but Walmart in particular, if the product doesn't sell, they send that stuff back.
Okay.
You know, it's a lot of risk, but we do invest heavily. At the same time, we do also compensate heavily as well, just because there's a lot of units sold.
Okay. Vera's asking a question. She wants to know, how many products does it take for you to find a winner?
Okay.
I'm wondering. Actually, that's kind of really interesting. Yeah, because it can be two different ways. One, how many inventors? How many products do you see from inventors to find a winner? And on the other side, how many products do you actually launch that you find a winner from?
Oh boy.
maybe even percentages.
Yeah, I mean, so as a merchandising team, we see a lot of products daily. I mean, we get a lot of phone calls, product submissions through website. We look at a lot. We do our own searches. I mean, we're looking at thousands a year. From that, I could just tell you that we roll out, I mean, if you look anywhere from 6 to 12 products a year, maybe even a little more, on a, you know, depending on the year.
Okay.
It's a product-based business. You know?
So that's fine. That's fair. So out of 6 to 12 products, how many are winners and how many are in the middle and how many kind of fail?
I can honestly say that most of our – so if you're looking at, let's say, the number six, let's say six of them,
mm-hmm.
5 out of 6 are great. Maybe one's, you know, still good, but it's just it's not great. Most of the products, we do a lot of due diligence in the background. We make sure that the consumer wants it. So when we get to retail, very, very, very few times do we find that it's a complete bomb. We do a lot of diligence, also does a lot of background work, a lot of legwork, to make sure that we're making the right decision, as far as pushing it to retail and getting it there. But yeah, I mean, most of them, honestly, Brian, they're very successful. There are many I can't even think of, I'm trying to think of one that really, I can't even pin one down.
That's okay. You want to forget those.
we try to have a short memory on those anyway, kind of zap those out of our mind.
Yep. Thank you, Vera, for that question. So it could be that through the process, you have an inventor that brought you the product and it's a successful product. You could end up selling millions of units. Does that instantly make an inventor a millionaire? And are the products that end up bombing, does the inventor end up getting anything from it? Maybe they were that 1 out of 6 that didn't do well?
You become a millionaire. I wouldn't go as far as a millionaire, but you're it's pretty sizable. You know, it's a very nice, checks. A lot of great compensation. You might be close, you know, you might be right there, but you know, every single time it would be probably an unrealistic way to look at it. If it's me, you know, even at those, if it goes to retail, the product source will be compensated, just because we will sell a lot of product there. We will sell a lot of product to the TV. It's just really a matter of getting the product to roll out. And, you know, there's the tests involved, and they're pretty extensive tests. So when we do get there, again, going back to the due diligence, we know that it's going to sell. And if that's the case, you know, the product's worth is going to be compensated for it as well.
Okay. Vicky has a question from Wisconsin. She wants me to ask you, what's your feelings on an inventor taking their product to market by themselves rather than bringing it to a company like Allstar?
I mean, the number one benefit, or one of the benefits of working with a company like Allstar, is that the risk is on us. You know, I see a lot of great products. I also understand, since starting to work at Allstar, the cost of having a product and bringing it to market if you really want to, if you choose to, and how big of a risk that it really can be. You know, it's, in order to successfully bring a product to retail, you have to be an expert in almost every aspect of the business, and it's a very hard thing to do. And companies like ourselves have worked many years, hard years, to get to that point. So, you know, it's definitely an option. You're going to be compensated differently, obviously, you're doing it yourself, but, I mean, the risk is so much greater. If it was presented in front of me and I had a product, I personally am more of a conservative person as it is, as far as, you know, making sure I'm doing making the right choice. I would probably go the route of having someone finance and also take that risk.
Okay. Well,
yeah. I mean, you know, it really depends. I mean, that's it's kind of a, you know, you're willing to roll the dice.
Yep. Do you work directly with the buyers, John?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. My job is strictly finding product, and that means your development companies, your inventors, your going to trade shows. We go to a lot of state fairs. So the woman that called from Wisconsin, mm-hmm. We went to your state fair. We were walking around trying to find the next hit. But yeah.
Okay. I want you to see, I guess, Vicky, you know, there's people out there that do bring their product to market by themselves. And, you know, having a company like an All-Star Direct Response, or a company that already has products that exist out there, to license it, you're basically leveraging their line and relationship with the buyers to kind of add your product to their product line and collect a royalty. There are inventors that have had products and they've brought it to the buyers and they have that one product and they accept them and they go through all the logistics and due diligence from the buyers, the big box retailers and so forth, but it's not impossible, but it's difficult.
Yeah, I mean, listen, those relationships take a long time to build. And at the same time, those retailers want to know that they're getting product that's going to sell. And, you know, they're going to trust someone like an All-Star with what they're saying, you know, with what they're shipping them and what they're providing them that they're going
to
sell.
Well, you also have stats. I mean, when you're you're bringing it to TV first, so when you're presenting it to the buyer probably says, okay, how did it do? Is it a marketable product, and are we going to sell them when they're on the shelves?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, basically you tell them, listen, you present it to them, and one of the questions they're going to ask you is, you know, how much, you know, is the consumer going to be aware of this product? Are they going to want it? And when you tell them you're running X amount of money in media and you're on national television, you know, they're going to understand that they want their product. The consumer's going to want it, so it's going to move off that shelf. But yeah, no, exactly. You nailed it.
All right. So, John, like I said in the beginning of the show, there's inventors listening at all stages of the invention process. Some of them have that napkin, the chicken scratch on a napkin, and have that idea, and they haven't done that Google search yet that you said. There's others that have that prototype. There's actually inventors that are listening that have products in retail right now, but just aren't satisfied with their retail distribution. So, you know, I'm sure that there's been lessons throughout this show that inventors have picked up, no matter what stage they're at. If you could just share with us some final words of wisdom, John, of what you think you can pass and leave us with before the show ends.
Sure. You know, there's a few things. It's number one, I think it goes back to the research. Make sure the due diligence is done behind the product. You know, you're doing your web searches. You're making sure that it's not out there already, because you know, you hate to kick your tires on something that is already out there. You want to make sure that all your efforts are being put towards something that's going to work, or at least you hope it's going to work. As far as finding a partner to work with, and when I mean partner, I'm saying a company. You know, I can honestly say on behalf of All-Star, you know, it's a great place to bring your product. At the very least, you know, at least get some feedback. You know, if you feel like you're not there yet and you want to reach out and have a quick discussion, we're there for you. You want to answer some questions for you, we're there. But it's a really fun, risk-free, you know, process. And we'd love to hear from everybody. But as far as just as far as inventing and some advice, I'd really do the research behind it and really, really look into the partner that you have. Make sure you trust them. Trust is a big thing. You want to make sure the company's transparent and that they're going to be there for you and look out for your best interests as well. At the end of the day, that product is everything that you put into it. You want to make sure it's in the right hands.
Sounds good. That sounds like a plan. And obviously, throughout the show, you've given the information on what they need to do before they present to you. So it'll probably be helpful for them to follow those steps, John, so you don't have to really reiterate it. It's already basically on here to say, listen, do your due diligence. Try to get to a point of where the prototype is there for us to kind of justify what it is that you're thinking about.